Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old-school greats and new-school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/Amazon Prime for details.
Hello and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me, as usual, is Rich. Hello, Rich.
What's up?
Hanging in there. We just passed another trade deadline. Always interesting and exciting times. And kind of generated the idea for the latest episode based on that, although it was something that we kind of expected to happen but didn't happen.
Yes.
We're talking about instances in which franchise icons were traded away. We wanted to sort of talk about instances where, you know, the player is still a plausible star. So, you know, Hakeem Olajuwon at the end of his career doesn't count,
for example,
which I guess was technically a signing trade. But, you know, stuff where, like, you know, it's still someone who's, you know, pretty good, important to the franchise's history, and doesn't leave for reasons where, you know, basically the player forces trade. So Vince Carter leaving the Raptors, for instance, doesn't really count because, you know, it's more the team's hand was kind of forced there. It wasn't really, you know, a mutual decision or a team kind of moving on, you know, into a new era. That's, I think, something different there. So, you know, we were expecting Kyle Lowry probably would be leaving the Raptors. The Raptors are kind of a team that's, you know, seems to be in transition. Seems like both sides were kind of realizing that, oh, okay, might be time to move on to the era, but at least for the moment, that's not happening.
Yeah, the whole idea of the show and the whole text chain that started it was, hey, you know, Kyle Lowry's going to get traded, so this might be a good idea. And we were like, yeah, sure. So we basically got a lot of the notes and got a lot of the ideas with the assumption that Kyle Lowry would be traded. Well, that did not happen, but do not fear. We found a suitable replacement, I would say, in a lot of ways. Not exactly the same, but gosh darn it, I think we did an okay job, given,
you know, yeah,
let's trade,
yeah,
that, well, gave us. So.
Right. I mean, Nikola Vucevic, you know, was traded from the Magic to the Bulls. And, you know, it's interesting because obviously Vucevic is not as important in NBA history as Lowry's going to end up being with, you know, a championship Raptors team and all that. But I mean, you know, he has been the defining player of the Magic in the post Dwight Howard era. You know, certainly, you know, been a very good player, you know, all-star a couple times, certainly a very good player and an important player in that franchise's history. But ultimately it's the, you know, the worst era for the team, and is probably, you know, a little bit like, let's say Buck Williams for the Nets, or even like Mitch Richmond for the Kings. And Williams and Richmond, I think, are both better players, certainly Richmond, than Vucevic was. But kind of a similar thing is like, well, yeah, kind of not really super remembered today because it's such a blah era for the team.
Yeah, like the best player in a terrible era for a franchise is still, I mean, it still kind of counts. And what's weird about Vucevic is I didn't know if I quite realized just how impactful and how long he was in Orlando as well. So he's played there for 8.5 years, which especially in today's NBA is a very, very long run, all the way from his age 22 to his age 30. And it wasn't until I kind of dug into the numbers that I realized, my God, he is like an Orlando Magic, you know, franchise, you know, icon or whatever you want to say. Obviously, like you said, the success is not there. It is the worst period in Orlando Magic history. But still, I mean, he's fourth in games played behind Nick Anderson, Jameer Nelson, and Dwight Howard. He's first in field goals and field goal attempts, which that kind of surprised me as well. Sixth in points per game behind McGrady, Shaq, Steve Francis, Penny Hardaway, and Dwight Howard, which obviously speaks to Orlando's early history and how good that early history was. And I guess it also speaks to Vucevic as well. And third in win shares, which I found pretty interesting as well, just behind Dwight Howard and Nick Anderson. And obviously Dwight Howard, a surefire Hall of Famer, you know, no slouch should be behind him. And Nick Anderson, obviously the what I would consider probably the next level of like franchise, you know, you have your Dwight Howards, your Tracy McGrady's, your Shaq's, your Penny's. The next level is in Nick Anderson. And I think you got to put Vucevic right on that next level. So, I mean, he's in that mix. He definitely counts for something. And yeah, it is, you know, the Lowry thing is a little tougher because Lowry, obviously a perennial playoff player. He wins the title with Toronto. So he's on an entirely different level because of that. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a bad, you know, run for Orlando, but still the Vucevic was a big part of whatever this era that you would call this Orlando Magic era, potentially the Vucevic era. I don't know. I guess history will dictate what we call this era of the Orlando Magic. But it wasn't a great era. But hey, he was the top dog in it. So hey, it was going to be about Lowry, so we made do with Vucevic. So live with it. All right, we were too far in the notes, so we had to retcon it a little bit. But again, I think we did an okay job. So.
But most of the players, if not all of them, we discuss will probably be more impactful in NBA history than Nikola Vucevic was. So just for
that's my Chicago Bulls' very own Nikola Vucevic. So you Chicago shut Bulls, up. Yes. All right.
Oh yeah,
him and Zach LaVine. I think Jason. I think sky is the limit right now.
They are diving into the play-in round. That's for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. They stumbled a little bit, but yeah, they're back on track. So the play-in round, the Eastern Conference Finals, the NBA Finals, the championship. It's all coming into place.
It all starts with the 10th seed.
Exactly. Right. That's what every team dreams of. Like, look, if we get the 10th seed, golly knows it's going to happen after that, guys.
Yeah, it's a miracle. Yeah, we believe in it. So
they still play. They still play five game rounds, right? Now are they seven still? Seven?
Sure. Who knows?
Seven's tough. Yeah, they should make that first round five again. That was better.
Hey, go back to three. You know,
three's even better. Yeah, you're right.
Exactly. Yeah, you never know what can happen in three game series. So, before we get into the show, we want to talk to you about our sponsor. And we are brought to you today by Danette May and Mindful Health LLC, featuring Danette May's top superfood product from her Earth Echo Foods line, Cacao Bliss.
Yes, nothing feels better than being able to enjoy rich, smooth, and creamy chocolate and knowing you are doing something good for your body. Echo Foods line, the Cacao Bliss, starts with 100% organic cacao beans that are naturally kissed by the sun, maintaining their miraculous health benefits.
And then they blend it with turmeric, MCT oil, coconut, Himalayan sea salt, cinnamon, and black pepper for the perfect blend to make you feel the best you ever have.
That sounds good to me. The result is you're going to fall in love with a truly decadent, healthy, guilt-free chocolate. You'll remove your cravings, you'll facilitate weight loss, you'll boost your energy, and you'll reduce your inflammation with one simple drink. Just one simple drink for all that stuff.
And not only that, it's friendly to paleo, gluten-free, keto, vegan, and vegetarian diets. Can you believe that?
That seems like it's too good to be true, Jason, if you ask me. But anyway, it is not, because for the last 8 years, they have been the global leader in the superfoods market, and they're proud to have served millions of customers worldwide. This is not a fly-by-night operation. They've been doing it for 8+ years, becoming a leader in the superfoods market. And today we are offering our listeners up to 15% off when they use the code MINUTE15. That's at earthecofoods.com/MinuteMedia. You go to earthecofoods.com/MinuteMedia and you'll get 50% off when you use that promo code MINUTE15. So make sure you do that again. earthecofoods.com/MinuteMedia. Use promo code MINUTE15 to get up to 15% off your first order there. So, all right, there you go. Thank you. Important to the podcast, important everything we do here. So,
great stuff. Yeah, you will not be making a mistake when you do that. Yeah, but something that was a mistake.
What a segue.
The Atlanta Hawks trading Dominique Wilkins to the Los Angeles Clippers. This happened on March 24th, 1994. They traded the legend Dominique Wilkins and a first round pick. They traded a first round pick to the Los Angeles Clippers for Danny Manning. So
thank God it's the Clippers and they drafted Greg Minor. So they're not, Atlanta doesn't have to kick themselves too much because they gave it to the Clippers and the Clippers would inevitably fuck it up. But yeah, what are you doing? Why are you doing this?
Right. We're considering this category, trading your legend when you probably shouldn't. A few other trades that we kind of considered here, and these are arguable, but you know, this is kind of what we're labeling it as: Patrick Ewing with the Knicks, Chet Walker with the Sixers, Walt Frazier with the Knicks. You know, in Ewing and Frazier's case, just feels like okay, they should just retire as Knicks. You know,
you're so close to the end. Just come on, get a two more seasons in there, and
And with Chet Walker, is like, you know, the Sixers, probably the biggest parallel to Wilkins. I mean, Walker isn't as important to Sixers history as Wilkins is to Hawks history, but definitely he was still an excellent player, you know, near his prime, ended up having a great second half of his career with the Bulls. You know, the Sixers gave him up for basically no reason. Now, Wilkins, a little bit later in his career, and I can kind of see some sense in this divorced of fan sentiment, because you got to think, you know, that at this point, you know, Wilkins, he's 34. He had an Achilles tendon rupture 2 years before, and he was about to be a free agent. So, you know, they didn't want to lose him. They didn't want to pay the money that it would take to keep him. So business-wise, you can at least kind of understand, you know, what they're thinking here. This is probably the most notorious instance of a team trading away the most legendary star in its history. I mean, basically forever altering the relationship between the team and the city. And yeah, I mean, I think to Hawks fans, you know, Dominique, I think, meant to the franchise the same as Magic Johnson to the Lakers, you know, Larry Bird to the Celtics, Michael Jordan to the Bulls, you know, basically equally unfathomable that he would be traded away, you know, 11 and a half years into his career. You know, his game really hadn't slipped yet. I mean, it would soon after this, but, you know, over the past two seasons, he'd averaged 28 points per game on 550 true shooting percentage, 6.6 rebounds per game, 2.7 assists, 1.1 steals. So his number is still really, really good. Not quite as efficient as he'd been, and, you know, certainly not quite the high flyer he'd been, but he was still, you know, excellent player. And, you know, the Hawks were 36-16 at the time of the trade. They had a 14-game win streak that year. They were first in their conference. Is actually the only time in NBA history that a team in first place in their conference traded their leading scorer after the All-Star break. So that's a pretty remarkable stat right there.
It is, yeah. And so I'm kind of with you that I think it makes some sense in purely like transactional player for player, talent for talent, or whatever, you can totally buy divorcing, you know, Dominique Wilkins and the aura that Dominique had and how important he was to Atlanta. You can definitely understand that if you got sent this trade, if you're the Atlanta GM at this time and you get sent the trade, we're going to give you Danny Manning, who's 6 years younger, two-time All-Star, who just led the freaking Clippers to the playoffs, for God's sakes. We're going to give you this guy if you give us Dominique Wilkins. And you could see that. You could absolutely say, okay, well, that's pretty interesting. With that said, like you said, once you add in that it's Dominique freaking Wilkins and you're the Atlanta Hawks, it makes it very difficult. But I totally understand if you divorce yourself from all that and if you just say, hey, from a purely business on the court sense, it makes all the sense in the world to hey, if you're going to take Dominique Wilkins for us and you're going to give us Danny Manning, like, okay, sure, that sounds great. And arguably, if, you know, let's say Danny Manning does, you know, go for another 10 years with the Atlanta Hawks and they make the playoffs a bunch of times and they make a bunch of runs in the East or whatever, would this still sting as much as it would? I mean, it probably would, but still, like, I think hindsight is being 2020 here, where if Danny Manning did carve out a nice career with Atlanta, maybe people would say, wow, what a solid trade that the Atlanta Hawks made there. You know, as Dominique is declining, they were able to move him for Danny Manning and keep the team together for, you know, another decade to have, you know, another run. And obviously it doesn't work that way, but yeah, you can totally sell yourself on it. The problem though is it's Dominique Wilkins in Atlanta, and you're right. He is one of those guys similar to a Patrick Ewing, similar to a Chet Walker, similar to a Walt Frazier, that you almost just say, ah, man, like, just keep him. You know what I mean? Like, come on. Like, you're, you know, let him retire with the team. Let him kind of end his career with the team. It totally makes all the sense in the world to do that. But it is tough. If this trade comes across your, you know, your desk, it's hard to pass it up. It really is. And yeah, I will defend him from that standpoint. But it does. It sucked for sure.
Right. What else is interesting is there is an article from Sports Illustrated. This is March 14th, 94. This is the infamous Baggett Michael Jordan baseball cover. This issue of Sports Illustrated. There is a article called Dan's the Man. The subhead is Danny Manning's acquisition by Atlanta has given the Hawks a leg up in the East. And at this point, the Hawks are actually 5-0 since the trade. Danny Manning had hit two game winners for the Hawks. And it highlights how well he was already fitting in, how well the Hawks were humming. It talks about how, you know, like, Wilkins had kind of clashed with some of the other players over the ball, particularly Kevin Willis, how, you know, that basically, you know, like, Lenny Wilkins was like, oh, you know, it's kind of nice to have somebody who passes the ball more and who has ball movement. And, you know, there was, you know, talk about how the Hawks were more fun to watch, you know, without, you know, Dominique holding the ball. And, you know, John Konkank, who's kind of the one holdover from the, you know, the mid 80s days of the Hawks, basically, I guess Willis was too. But he has a quote that says, you know, I know it makes me a much better shooter to get the pass when I expect it rather than with 2 seconds on the shot clock after somebody has dribbled and weaved and spun and couldn't get their shot and then flicked it out to me and said, launch.
Ouch.
Right. Now, he was more positive about – he said other things that were very nice about me on that one. So
you like the Baggett Michael headline. You're taking salacious parts of an article and using it to sell magazines, Jason. How dare you? Yeah. You and Sports Illustrated really on some kick these days.
I guess, and there's some more insight that they basically, you know, it sounds like the Atlanta GM, who is Pete Babcock, and Wilkins agent Steve Kaufman, you know, they had been kind of talking about it for a while, you know, since that summer, thinking that maybe, you know, this is funny, you know, but that the idea that They're in L.A. Maybe, you know, Donald Sterling would offer, you know, Nick more money. Than
yeah,
the Hawks
fucking
would have,
right, Steve. Okay, yeah. Steve, you idiot. What are you talking about? No, he's not.
Right.
It's Donald Sterling. Okay, Steve. Oh, no. Hey, well, if Donald in L.A. Okay, yeah, sure. Great.
Yeah. So in the regular season, it worked out fine. You know, in terms of on the court, you know, the Hawks finished with the number one seed. They were 57-25 in the East. They were 19-7 in games that Manning played. They had almost a 5 SRS for the entire season, but they were upset in the second round by the fifth-seeded Pacers, who had 10 fewer wins that year. And honestly, what seems like a terrible playoff series, all 6 games had margins of 11 or more points. So not a fun playoff series for anybody to watch. And then Manning, you know, there was some talk that, oh, yeah, you know, like, we think we can bring him in. You know, we think we can keep him. That was part of it. But, yeah, he ends up only signing a 1-year, $1 million deal with Phoenix. That's weird. But then he would tear his left ACL in his first year with the Suns and then would sign with the Suns with a deal of 6 years and $40 million in the offseason. So
I don't understand any of this. What is going on? Was this some under-the-table deal that Phoenix was like – trying to avoid attacks? Have we revealed something here? Like, this has to be like, they had to be like a handshake agreement that, hey, we're going to sign you for this deal right now, but like, actually it's this deal type.
Right.
Because I don't understand why he would sign a 1-year, $1 million deal. First off, I don't understand why Atlanta traded for him and then didn't offer him a contract right away, but I guess it's the Atlanta Hawks, so it's whatever.
I think they offered him a contract, and he just did not accept it. He decided to go to the Suns instead. So
for the 1 year, something's a little fishy here. I don't know. I don't like it.
Right. So I do not remember. I mean, yes, I'm sure there was some sort of this type of agreement. Whether he actually, you know, whether it was illegal under the time or not, I don't remember that at all. Or they felt that, you know, so I guess, okay, they said that, I guess Jerry Colangelo said, like, hey, you know, Manning, he made a sacrifice to sign with us for 1 year for $1 million, so we're going to give him, you know, the contract that you know that he should have. So, and they were like clear that it's like, well, he came back from his rehab, he's looking good, you know, we're willing to take the risk, basically. So, and you know, he ended up playing well for Phoenix, although definitely, you know, would be affected by the injuries for the rest of his career. But he won Sixth Man of the Year. Like, I mean, he had a pretty good career even after that, but obviously, you know, not a star level player after that point.
No, yeah, those injuries definitely did a number on him, and I'm kind of looking at some stuff here, and they said that you know, I'm looking at a New York Times article at the time, the actual day of the transaction. It just says the NBA team would have to rework its payroll to get Manning under the league's salary cap because the Suns had just signed veteran AC Green to a 5-year deal worth $25 million. So I don't know. Yeah, something, some sort of risk or some sort of whatever. But Manning is quoted as saying, you know, he wanted to win a championship there. So maybe it was just like, hey, look, I'm sick of playing for, you know, the LA Clippers and bad teams. So I'm going to go to Phoenix for 1 year, $1 million. I don't know. It's a little wild. And again, I'm very, very strange for a lot of reasons why, you know, Atlanta wasn't able, why he didn't want to stay with Atlanta for whatever reason, why he signed with Phoenix for 1 year, $1 million or whatever. But I guess it ended up working out. He got the big deal. And like you said, he never quite got back to where he was at this point in the career with the injuries kind of piling up. But he ended up carving out a pretty nice career, just not as like a number one guy or a star like a lot of people at this time thought that was the trajectory for him. A very, very Phoenix thing here. They signed a lot of guys in the 90s with the idea that, hey, this guy's our star, we're ready to go. I ended up working for many of those guys. So,
sure. So perhaps even worse, Dominique ends up signing a deal with the Boston Celtics. I guess it was 3 years, $10.9 million, but he only played in Boston for 1 year. So, not sure exactly what happened there. Apparently, the Clippers had offered him a $7.5 million over 3 years, and with a $800,000 bonus for making the playoffs, but he ended up turning that one down. So I guess, you know, it was okay offer from the Clippers, but not that fantastic. So NBA Trades, one of our favorite blogs, has a great article on the situation, and there's some quotes that we found there that I think were worth talking about. So Dominique Wilkins himself from the LA Times said, hey, I'm surprised that it went down, but I think it's probably the best move for me, even though I felt we had a chance to compete for a championship this year. Also, Seattle Times says that he said the reception you got with the Clippers, they've given me more respect here than I ever got in Atlanta, which is really kind of a surprising thing.
Are you sure? Are you sure? I mean, I understand, you know, we're all a little tense right now, but
yeah.
Are you sure about that? I don't know.
Yeah.
Don Sterling, Clippers, are you sure?
Right. Yeah. Kevin Lockery, who was at that point, a Sports Illustrated analyst, former Hawks head coach, you know, former long time NBA head coach, his quote, which ended up being exactly correct. This is a franchise killer, by far the toughest trade for Atlanta fans. In all honesty, skill wise, this is not a bad trade. However, from a fan base, it set the Hawks back a long way. I've been in Atlanta for 20 years, and Dominique has been the biggest star athletically in those 20 years, and that's counting baseball, football, and hockey twice. So pretty it ended up being pretty much exactly the deal. Yeah, I lived in Atlanta for a few years, as you know, and definitely something, you know, about 10 years after this trade, and it was something that people still talked about. It's like, yeah, I stopped being a Hawks fan pretty much after, you know, they traded away Dominique. It was, you know, like ripping my heart out kind of thing. And yeah, maybe if they'd been able to keep Manning and he'd been successful, or at least, you know, been able to advance to the finals that year and had Manning, I think the trade might have been thought of differently. I'm not sure, you know, that keeping him would have had a good outcome either. You know, like I don't know if like the fans are going to stick around post Dominique Wilkins. I think he's just the kind of that iconic guy that no matter how he left, it probably was going to hurt the team, hurt the fans, but probably, you know, him being traded away in the midst of a really successful season probably did hurt that. Now, one thing that was a benefit of not re-signing Manning or Dominique is that they did eventually have the cap room to sign Dikembe Mutombo, who was their biggest free agent ever, and they, you know, had some good success in the late 90s, you know, because of that. So they did bounce back, you know, a couple years later pretty well. But yeah, it, from a fan base perspective, yeah, as we said, it definitely was very harmful.
No, you're absolutely right that it's really difficult to figure out how to get rid of a guy, you know, an icon like that. Like that's where you really, really hope that like that dude just retires. You know what I mean? Like just after the year, he's just like, you know what, I'm done. I don't want to play anymore. It's like, oh, phew, thank God. We don't have to like, you know, or, you know, you give him your best offer and he goes, nah, you know what, I really want to go back and play with X or whatever. Or, you know, I want to play in my hometown of, you know, so it's stuff like that you really kind of hope for that makes either him the bad guy or it's like a mutually agreed upon, like he just retires and it's like, oh, thank God, we don't have to really kind of do this. Because, yeah, there's really no way, whether you don't re-sign or whether you trade him, it was not going to go well with an icon like that, especially a guy who still did want to play for a few more years. So, yeah, I don't know that there was ever a great solution to it, but this one maybe not the best. But let's move on to our next one here. So sending your legend back home. And this one we're going to talk about is Clyde Drexler from the Portland Trail Blazers. The trade goes down. Let me get the exact date for you guys. It is February 1995. I want to make sure I have the exact date. February 14th, 1995. The Portland Trail Blazers trade Clyde Drexler with Tracy Murray to the Houston Rockets for Otis Thorpe, Marcelo Nicola, and a 1995 first-round draft pick. It ended up becoming Randolph Childress. So we don't have to worry about that first-round draft pick or Marcelo Nicola ever again. But, yeah, some other examples of this. Dave Bing is an interesting one, getting sent from the Pistons to the Bullets, you know, kind of a legend going back to his hometown in kind of the latter stages of his career where he's still competitive. He's still a decent player, but definitely on the backswing of his career. And that's really, you know, we'll talk about the history of Clyde here, but, you know, he comes in 1983, already a very talented Blazers team coming off a 46-win season, a conference semifinals appearance. They have Michael Thompson, Jim Paxson, Calvin Natt, Fat Lever at this time as well. And Clyde is actually, he's drafted 14th overall. A lot of people forget that about Clyde Drexler. Probably definitely overplayed his draft position for sure, which is weird. I would love to kind of know, and I don't know enough about this era of NBA draft, you know, knowledge or whatever, but you know, he was a pretty big deal in college, like a very, very good player, obviously a part of the Houston, who a great college team. I'm pretty surprised he fell all the way to 14th given his body and the, you know, how competitive he was in college basketball. But anyway, the reason he does go to a pretty good Blazers team is that he actually came in a draft or came 14th because of a trade, I should say, with the Denver Nuggets. He was traded as a future first round draft pick to the Blazers for T.R. Dunn. So the Nuggets said, hey, you can take these draft picks, but we really, really want T.R. Dunn. And I guess, yeah, T.R. Dunn, he was good for the Nuggets, I guess. But I guess you'd rather have Clyde Drexler than T.R. Dunn, probably. I would. Yeah. I don't know about you. I shouldn't put words in your mouth, Jason. But
sure.
Do you think Clyde Drexler is a better player than T.R. Dunn?
I mean, I think so, but I just defended halfway the Dominic Wilkins trade. So, yeah,
you're not really anybody we should really be asking about this. But no, either one. Yeah. One of those classic good for both team trades. 10% TR done. And Portland got Clyde Drexler, so it ended up working. But anyway, I kind of forgot about this as well. When he is drafted by Portland, he has kind of a contract impasse with Portland. He knocks out his entire first training camp, and they kind of ease him in because of that. He's eased into his role. He starts only three games his rookie year, averages just 7.7 points per game in his rookie season. By his third year, though, Drexler really does arrive onto the scene. He makes the All-Star game. He finishes the year with 18.5 points per game. He would then miss one All-Star game in 1987. Then he'd have a streak of seven straight from 1988 to 1994. And of course, unfortunately, the early parts of Drexler's career and really all of Drexler's career is unfortunately mired by the decision of Portland to not draft Michael Jordan in the 1984 draft because they had Clyde and they didn't need another guard. So they instead draft big man Sam Bowie.
If I may interrupt for a moment, that's incredibly stupid given the fact that he averaged 7.7 points per game in his rookie season. Like there was no sense that Clyde Drexler was going to be a huge star after that. I would think after that point, you know,
right. It's really strange. And yeah, that's, I was kind of thinking like, you know, then cause I always forgot that he got eased into it. Cause I, for whatever reason, always thought Clyde Drexler got drafted like pretty high and they're like, hey, it's Clyde Drexler, go play and score points for us and do everything. But it's not that way. Like they, you know, they kind of dick him around on contract stuff. He comes and then they average 7 points per game and starts only three games. Like, I don't know. I probably just draft Michael Jordan, but it's actually an interesting quote I was able to find here of Jack Ramsey, who was the coach of Portland at this time. And he says about not drafting Michael Jordan. He says, we have played games in which three guys, Vandeweghe, they just gotten Kiki Vandeweghe as well, Jim Paxson and Clyde Drexler, who played Jordan's position, scored 80 points. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Cool. Like, all right.
All right.
I mean, all right. Then, all right. Go get Sam Bowie. So, yeah, I don't know. I've always thought that it was like, well, Portland made a good move, but now, like, more and more as I kind of do some research, especially looking at this, it's like, I mean, I probably would have just drafted Michael Jordan. Like, Clyde really wasn't, like, a sure thing yet. And yeah, I don't know. It's very strange. But Jack Ramsey was pretty confident. And I guess he was rewarded with that confidence because Drexler does, by 1988, kind of ascend into what I would call, you know, pretty much superstardom. At this point, he averages more than 27 points per game in two straight seasons. He makes the All-NBA third team in 1988. By 1990, he helps the Blazers to their first NBA Finals since 1977. They'd be going up against the defending champion Detroit Pistons. Obviously, it doesn't work out very well for Portland. Detroit goes back-to-back, but Drexler performs well, 26.4 points per game, 7.8 rebounds per game, 6.2 assists per game, and 1.8 steals per game for Drexler during those finals, so he played his role there. The run, though, solidified Drexler's kind of Portland's franchise cornerstone, and following the season, he agrees to a one-year contract extension, which we'll talk about that in a sec. It featured a balloon payment of $8.75 million. The reason for that is the NBA is currently going under an ongoing collective bargaining agreement discussion, and the Blazers wanted to guarantee that they could pay their star when the time came. But that balloon payment becomes the highest annual salary for an athlete in any team sport, and would be eclipsed many, 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 many times over, obviously, especially in the NBA when contracts go nuts and the new collective bargaining comes out. But anyway, the following year, Portland wins 63 games, the best record in the league. Clyde would finish sixth in MVP voting and earn all NBA second team honors. Portland makes it to the Western Conference Finals for the second consecutive year. But ultimately, the Los Angeles Lakers beat them to set up the NBA Finals matchup against the Michael Jordan led Chicago Bulls. Does not go very well for the Lakers, and that's kind of the end of the Lakers dynasty. And then by 1992, the Blazers are ready again. Everything kind of comes together for the team. They finish with the best record in the West, 57 wins. Drexler makes the All-NBA first team as well. He has averages of 25 points per game, 6.6 rebounds per game, and 6.7 assists per game. He finishes second in MVP voting behind Michael Jordan, and that made this finals matchup that much more interesting. Sports Illustrated has a big article kind of previewing the series. It's called, the headline says, on a collision course, Michael Jordan and his number one rival, Portland's Clyde Drexler, are primed for a playoff showdown. So there we go. I don't know. I like this series as a Bulls fan, but it doesn't go very well. I would say this is probably the best Jordan Bulls team, this 1992 team, and they're absolute machines this year. And Portland, you know, they valiantly play. They end up going, you know, winning the, you know, they really do try here, but it's like, I don't think anybody was going to beat this 1992 Bulls team because they cruise to a finals win. Michael Jordan hits some threes, shrugs. Cliff Robinson does some stuff. It's not enough. The Bulls win. So Bulls win the title there. Then the team, Portland, unfortunately regresses in 1993 and 1994. Drexler's starting to slow down a little bit. Have some injury issues as well. He'd make two more All-Star games, but he'd play only 49 games in 1993, and his point per game average falls below 20 points per game for the first time since 1986. And then a lot of things start to happen here in this 1994 offseason. The Trailblazers restructure their front office. Top decision maker and vice president of basketball operations, Jeff Petrie, he resigns. He's replaced by Bob Whitsitt. Is it Whitsitt? I never knew how to pronounce this guy's name, but
I think it's Whitsitt. Yeah.
Whitsitt. Yeah. So Whitsitt. On the coaching side, though, more importantly, Rick Adelman is fired and the Blazers bring in PJ Carlissimo as his replacement. I always thought PJ was like, but everybody hated PJ, man. Like,
yeah.
I'm looking through these quotes. We'll talk about these quotes a little bit, but man, they didn't like PJ here. Sprewell didn't really like PJ. I would say that's the safe assumption. Did anybody like PJ? He got a lot of jobs, so somebody liked him, but man. Anyway, this is the beginning of the end because Drexler sounds very unsure about this. This is from the Moscow Pullman Daily News. I don't believe that's Moscow, Russia. I believe it's another town called Moscow. But maybe Moscow, Russia is very, very interested in Blazers. Sure. and Rick Adelman and the coaching to hire. But regardless, here's Drexler's quote. He says, some people may say it's a very sad day, and I agree. Some people may say it's a new beginning or a new dawn. That will have to wait. and find out. So that doesn't sound very good. That sounds like a man who does not like what's going on. Another issue in Portland, Chris Dudley's contract, which was a constant issue at this time with pretty much every team had this effect in some way, shape, or form. Obviously, in The Last Dance, the Scottie Pippen deal, very famous one as well, where he signs his deal before that CBA, then pretty much everybody after him gets paid a lot more money, and he's looking like, hey, what the hell? You know, where's my money? Sean Kemp in the Seattle Supersonics, obviously that would become an issue with, what, Joe Klein, right, where he'd get just ungodly amounts of money. And Sean Kemp would say, hey, what about my money? Well, in this case in Portland, it's Chris Dudley, one of our famous, one of our very, very favorite players that played forever and never really did anything at all. But hey, he got a lot of money because the Blazers signed Dudley the previous year with the intent to re-sign him to the following year to a six-year, $24 million contract under a loophole through the Bird exception. So they did everything they could to give Chris freaking Dudley 6 years and $24 million. This made Dudley the second highest paid Blazer. And then obviously guys like Clyde Drexler, Terry Porter, Buck Williams, and Cliff Robinson all had contracts that were much, much smaller and were much, much better players than Chris Dudley. So, Definitely understandable there. And that was a constant issue in this time period with that new CBA where guys would look at guys that got more money than them and say, what the hell's going on here? But anyway, Drexler in Portland, not happy in his biography, Clyde the Glide. He says this, quote, I would have never let Rick go, Rick Adelman, obviously. We had a great relationship. It hurt when he was fired. I mean, first you take away my center and Kevin Duckworth. Then you take away my coach. Then Jeff Petrie was gone. And they also removed the team doctor, Bob Cook. I really enjoyed those people. I had some problems with that. I was extremely unhappy with those moves. During camp, I went to Bob and told him I wanted a trade. He said, Clyde, let's wait and see what we have. See how this team is playing. Let's give PJ a chance. If you really want to be traded, play well so I can get someone good in return for you. I just wanted to get out at that point. My role on the team had changed. I was no longer the do everything guy. I had fewer opportunities to do things. It was probably for the best. They weren't sure how healthy I was going to be. PJ tried to work with me. He was trying to get Rod Strickland more of a chance to create and penetrate, trying to get Cliff Robinson a few more scoring opportunities, and trying to bring along some of the younger players. The team worked hard together. We played hard. PJ demanded that. I like that about him. So, hey, okay. Clyde doesn't hate PJ anymore. No. In 2004, he decided, I guess I don't hate him that much. Anyway, Drexler then demands to be traded. He does it privately, kind of tells these guys, okay, I think we're done here. And then after being involved in a rumored deal to Miami, Harold Miner for Clyde Drexler. What do you think about that one?
sounds great. Harold Miner, you know, he dunks just like Jordan. He's going to be great.
Baby Jordan. Yeah, a little baby Jordan there. That would have been a very interesting deal for Portland. Say, hey, look, we didn't get Michael Jordan in 1984, but we got the new Michael Jordan, Harold Miner, and then that wouldn't have gone well either. Clyde Drexler in Miami is an interesting fit in 1995. I wonder how it goes. But finally, in February, the trade is made, and Drexler was reunited with his former college teammate, Hakeem Olajuwon, his hometown team, and he has a chance to join a team that had just won the championship the year prior. Obviously, most people know, or if you're a fan of NBA history, you know that team really struggled in the following season. Clyde Drexler comes, and then things kind of come together for that team. It works out well. They would, of course, win the title, go back-to-back. Clyde would finally get a championship in the NBA. He played consistently good basketball. I kind of forgot about this as well. He played really, you know, decent enough basketball until he retired finally in 1998. And as far as Drexler's career, to this day, still to this day, Clyde Drexler is the Blazers' career leader in games, minutes played, field goals, field goal attempts, free throws, offensive rebounds. Clyde Drexler, still number one in Blazers history. I love that. Nice. Steals, points, triple doubles, and win shares. So yeah, iconic player in Blazers history. And I guess this is how one of these trades can go pretty well, because I think things have kind of smoothed over with Clyde and Portland. I don't think he really is too upset when he says, hey, I want to go, and then you trade him to, you know, his hometown team and he wins a title. That's a good way to you know, make sure that this nobody's upset afterwards and everybody gets what they wanted out of the trade. So congratulations. Yeah.
So I have a TR Dunn fact.
Oh, I love TR Dunn facts. Go ahead.
I know that you do. So of all of the players who have played more than 950 games in NBA history, TR Dunn has the second fewest points per game at 5.1 points per game in his career, and also has the second fewest points per 36 minutes with 7.9 points per 36 minutes. The only player with fewer points per 36 minutes. Do you want to guess who that is?
Oh, man. Okay. Is it Chris Dudley?
It is not Chris Dudley, although Joe Klein is the player who has the fewest points per game overall. Like, he has 4.7, 4.8, something like that. But per minute, he's only the 18th worst. So it is a defensive-minded player best known for his play in the 2000s.
Oh, Ben Wallace?
There you go. Yes.
Yeah, yep. There we go.
7.0. And T.R. Dunn is next with 7.9, Caldwell Jones, 9.0, Tree Rollins, 9.4, and Michael Cage, 10.0. So
was T.R. Dunn, like, did he even like pass half court? Like, how do you not score like more points with those Denver teams? I know he was like a defensive guy, but did he just like never pass half court? Was he just like, you guys got it, I'm good. Like, I'll come back on defense. Like, don't worry about me. Like, how do you just not like by accident score 10 points a game?
Yeah, that is kind of crazy because
they're scoring like 140 a game. Like, what are you doing?
I mean, he. Yeah, I mean he was scoring like, you know, 8 points a game for a while, and then like his last 4 years, he's averaging like fewer than 4 points per game, and playing for, you know, mostly full time. So I don't know. I think those dragged it down a bit when they weren't quite as run and gun in the late '80s until, you know, they got Paul Westphal again. Mm-hmm, so, yeah. That is interesting. Yeah,
it just feels like in those Doug Moe days, like,
right? Yeah,
everybody got theirs. Except for TR.
Yeah. I mean, in fairness, they had three guys averaging like 25 points per game. So, you know, I mean, there were only so many points to go around. Even if you're scoring, you know, a lot of points, you know, when those three guys are taking the ball so much, there's not a lot of room for TR Dunn to, you know, get a shot.
That's true. And yeah, Alex English and Dan Issel, they're not really interested in passing the ball to you very much either. Right. So yeah. That's why I do wonder. I'd love to watch one of those games and see if he even bothers to like go on the fast break, or he's just like, I'm not getting the ball anyway. Just you guys go. Yeah. Like, it's fine. Yeah, because he's only taking like four shots. So it's not like he's missing. I mean, he's just not taking shots. He's just not involved in the offense whatsoever. But hey, that's not why they needed him. They had enough scores. They needed somebody to play a little bit of defense. So good for him.
Yeah. There you go. So, all right. Our next category is looking at. After a player has made a trade request, not a demand, a request, we're going to look at Jack Sigma, who was traded by the Seattle Supersonics, along with a second round draft pick that became Bob McCann, and another 1989 second round draft pick that became Scott Hafner. On July 1st, 1986, he was traded to the Milwaukee Bucks for Alton Lister, a 1970 or 1987
first round. That'd be a real bad trade.
That would be, yeah.
Give us a 1970 draft pick. Like, well, all right. Like,
yeah.
That's somebody from the 70s. Like, just give me an old player if you want.
Yeah. That's even worse than any of the Pete Babcock trades. Yeah. 1987 first round draft pick that was Mark Jackson. Yes, that Mark Jackson, you know, Knicks, you know, bad announcer, you know, Mark Jackson.
Bad coach. Bad
yeah, coach. Right. Yeah.
Weird Mark Jackson. Spy guy that spied on his coaches and team. And
yeah. Yeah. By the way, Mark Jackson is 19th in points per 36 minutes for players that criteria. So
what a boring ass player to watch too. I mean, before he was a coach, I hated watching Mark Jackson. Stupid back downs. Get out of here.
He at least had fun passes, but yeah, I get what you're saying. And then a 1989 first round draft pick of Jeff Sanders. So, the Sonics made a whole lot of trades in that 87 draft. I mean, they obviously traded, you know, they traded the pick that was Scottie Pippen and all that good stuff. There's a lot of mess of things.
Yeah, they got Olden Polonies, though. So, I mean, yeah.
They did. Hey, it worked out. We'll get to another interesting.
You have an Olden Polonies fact?
Not an Olden Polonies fact, but a trade that stemmed after this trade. So we'll save it for the end because it's good stuff. So other examples of the situation, obviously Clyde Drexler, there was a trade request there, as we talked about. Bob Lanier going to the Pistons, from the Pistons to the Bucks. Oscar Robertson also to the Bucks from the Royals. Derek Harper to the Knicks. You know, situations like that. Plenty of other examples, but those are a few of the ones that they want to highlight here. And yes, Sigma, you know, the last remaining player from the Sonics 1979 championship team. You know, the glory days with Gus Williams and Dennis Johnson, Lenny Wilkins as the coach. you know, they remain a, you know, a strong, pretty solid contender, you know, into the early 80s. But they lose Dennis Johnson. They don't get much out of Paul Westphal, who replaced him. He was a falling out between between Johnson and Lenny Wilkins' coach. Gus Williams holds out for a year. You know, the Lakers obviously come on strong in the West, and, you know, the Sonics, you know, they, despite being a young team when they won the championship, you know, kind of lost their window there. And then the prior two seasons before Sigma asked for trade, they had been 31-51. You know, at that point, he had been a seven-time All-Star. He had 4 years left on his contract, estimated to be worth $1.65 million a year. Probably a little bit more than he was worth on the court, but obviously he was really important in Sonics history. And, you know, they would talk about how, like, you know, Bob Whitsitt, who was the team president of Sonics, basically said, like, yeah, we would never have wanted, you know, we never would have felt comfortable trading for him because of how much he meant to the franchise if he hadn't ever had the request. So, yeah, and so 2 months before the trade, he had asked to be traded, saying he wanted to play on a team with a chance to win an NBA championship. And then, you know, so they end up getting Alton Lister. Alton Lister had spent 5 years with the Bucks. He was older than I realized. He was 27 at the time. He would last for 3 years on the Sonics. Ironically, he's probably most famous for being on the other end of a ferocious dunk from Sonic Sean Kemp.
That's the point dunk, right?
Yes. The point dunk. I put it here in the notes. I thought I was going to say it for the end, but we're going to reveal it now. So Lister would end up being traded to the Warriors in the summer of 1989 for what would become the number two pick in 1990, the Gary Payton.
Look at that. So, Alton Lister, a very important figure in Sonics history, both for getting his ass dunked on by Sean Kemp, for becoming Gary Payton, and for spending a few years at the Sonics. So good for him.
Right. And Gary Payton, you know, if the Warriors had that pick, then Gary Payton would have played in Oakland, where he's from. So all kinds of irony there. The Sonics, you know, they actually ended up doing okay here. You know, they were able to, you know, revamp. They actually improved by 8 wins to 39-43, added Dale Ellis in the offseason as well. And he went from, you know, he became a star in Seattle. They made a surprising run to the Western Conference Finals, and they'd still, you know, they'd remain like a, you know, in the low 40s win, solid but unspectacular into the early 90s. Eventually they'd catch fire with Gary Payton and Sean Kemp. So, you know, they were all right here. I want to get into a article from the November 3rd, 1986 Sports Illustrated called "A Buck for a Change." It's by Bruce Newman. Of course, about, you know, Sigma being on the Bucks. Don Nelson, you know, describes Sigma. He was then the Milwaukee coach. Described him as not a dominating center, but says, hey, we feel like we've really improved ourselves, that this move puts us in a position to win it all. So, you know, feeling like, okay, now, you know, we've got a center, you know, we've got a true center. We've got somebody who can, you know, compete with the other big, you know, players, the Kareems, you know, the Twin Towers in Houston, et cetera. You know, there's a, and here, like, it refers to how 4 years ago, the Sonics then general manager, he was asked whether he would consider trading Sigma for Moses Malone. And then the quote was, this is Zoli Volchak, who was the GM then for the Sonics. I wouldn't trade Jack Sigma for the resurrection of Marilyn Monroe in my bedroom, which maybe a little strong, but, you know,
I mean, yeah,
hey. Because yeah, Moses Malone, maybe, you know, you'd want him, but, and then Bob Whitsitt also said,
I'd rather Marilyn Monroe, Moses Malone than Jack Sigma, right. But you know, that whatever.
Would be good. Yeah.
I mean, Sigma, I like Sigma too. Good player, but Marilyn Monroe and sure Moses could really do some work. And
I'm sure Marilyn Monroe could do some good work in the
past. I don't know. I would have probably taken either, but hey, you know what? He stuck by his man, Jack Sigma. Yeah.
Jack Sigma, hey, you know? And Bob Whitsitt said, hey, you know, Jack Sigma's bigger than the Space Needle. If we wanted to trade...
That's not true. I've seen the Space Needle. It's very large.
Right. Well, you know, perhaps figuratively.
Got it.
And there was some tension between Sigma and Lenny Wilkins, who at this point was not the coach, but still the GM, basically saying, hey, you know, any player making the kind of money that Sigma was should be loyal to the team, win or lose. Sigma apparently was a part of a group of veterans who basically went to the owner and asked, you discuss the team's problem, and then Wilkins ended up being just, the general manager after that. There was some interesting things there. And this was out of the Milwaukee playbook. They had, traded for Bob Lanier in 1980, similar situation, with the Pistons, where, he'd been the top guy for a struggling team. They'd also gotten Dave Cowens, who made a comeback after retiring. Lanier, it went well. Cowens, he ended up getting hurt in the preseason, didn't really play that well for the Bucks. Also very interestingly is Bucks actually did have a chance to draft Sigma in the 1977 draft. They had two of the first three choices in the draft. They picked Kent Benson first and Marcus Johnson third, and then they had, I think, the seventh pick, or sixth or seventh pick there. And they didn't take Sigma, and Sigma was actually kind of a surprise pick at number eight overall. He played for a small college and wasn't that well known. And then Don Nelson said that day, "I think Seattle made a mistake. We might have picked Sigma in the second round if we had used up all 22 choices in the first round." So, which is a pretty bold thing to say.
That is very bold to say. The day of, too.
The day of the draft, right.
So puffy chested there. Wow, Don Nelson. Yeah. Jeez.
And then Nelson would say later, "I was young and dumb. Hell, I hadn't even seen him play." So,
Well, he drafted Kent Benson number one. So, what do you know? Marcus Johnson, good pick there, though. Good pick.
Yeah, three, right. That worked out pretty well. Yeah. Unfortunately for the Bucks, adding Sigma didn't really bear a lot of fruit. He averaged his lowest points per game total, 12.7, since his rookie season. The Bucks were seven games worse than they had been the prior season. They won only 50 games. They did take the Celtics, who ended up making the finals, to seven games in the second round. But this was really the last season that they were any kind of true finals contender. Mm-hmm. Don Nelson ended up leaving after the season. They went to Del Harris, and the Bucks were basically, a good team, but kind of mid to high 40s win team for the rest of Sigma's career. No longer really a finals contender. So Sigma played well. They got good years out of him, but they definitely, with the rest of the team aging and just kind of the time had sort of passed, and they were unfortunately unable to break through.
Yeah, the window had definitely closed on that Bucks franchise title hope, and that kind of gets us into our next one here, which is time for a new era. Jason Kidd being traded from the New Jersey Nets, February 19th, 2008 is when the trade happens. There's a lot of names here, so I will try to quickly go over them. It's a very confusing trade in a lot of ways, but anyway, the New Jersey Nets trade Jason Kidd, Malik Allen, and Antoine Wright to the Dallas Mavericks for Maurice Ager, Dasagna Jop, Devin Harris, Trenton Hassel, Keith Van Horn, a 2008 first-round pick ended up being Ryan Anderson, and a 2010 first-round pick would ended up being Jordan Crawford. So some other examples of a trade like this, Kevin Garnett being traded from the Timberwolves to the Celtics, Russell Westbrook being traded to the Rockets, Steve Nash to the Lakers, Marc Gasol and Mike Conley, getting moved from the Memphis, Chris Mullin to the Pacers, Paul Pierce to the Nets, Nate Thurman to the Bulls, guys that are still very good, but it's just kind of time for them to move on from their current franchise. Their current franchise is kind of going in a different direction or whatever. And that's what happens here with Jason Kidd. So, a little bit of background on Jason Kidd. He obviously established himself as a star over the first few years of his career, although a troubled one for a lot of different reasons. His tenure in Dallas ends very poorly with injuries, plus everybody on the team hating one another, which did not go very well for team success. He is then traded to the Suns with Tony Dumas for Michael Finley, AC Green, and Sam Cassell. The Suns improved greatly with Kidd, as well as their early small ball lineup. They were a really revolutionary team at this time, too, with three-pointers, playing very small ball stuff with Jason Kidd, Kevin Johnson, Rex Chapman, and Steve Nash all on the same team, plus Antonio McDyess. It's a very successful team for Phoenix, but ends up, obviously, Antonio McDyess, short-lived run there, but move on to go back to Denver and the idea of having Jason Kidd, Kevin Johnson, Rex Chapman, Steve Nash all kind of playing at the same time didn't really, outside of that one year, didn't really bear the fruit that a lot of people thought it would. good. By 1999, Kidd really ascends into the upper echelon of point guards in the league. He wins his first ever assist title. He leads the NBA with 7 triple doubles, back when triple doubles were really interesting and cool and different and unique and not, you know, something that Russell Westbrook does while he's being bad and playing for bad teams. The rest of the league, just to let you know, had only 11 in that entire year that he has 7. So a pretty important thing there. He also has a career high in points, rebounds, and steals, and ranked top 50 in 10 different stats. In 1999 as well. The next season, the Suns decide, okay, we got Jason Kidd. He's a star. We need to put him with another star. And they acquire Penny Hardaway from the Orlando Magic. And on paper, this team seems destined for big things. They get the very terrible nickname, and I need your ruling here, Jason, of, quote, Backcourt 2000. What do you think of
that? Is
Backcourt 2000?
That's almost as good as Legion of Doom 2000.
Yes. Oh, yeah. LOD 2000 went very, very well. And this went about the same, I would say, equally as well. The LOD 2000 may have been a little bit better because they had Sonny and no microfracture surgeries, but they did have, you know, Hawk being drunk and falling off a Titantron or whatever. So I guess things went. But if you weren't alive in this period, everything was X 2000. And this started in like 1997. People just started calling everything something 2000. So it was only natural that this dumb pairing would be called Backcourt 2000. And I don't have to tell you how Backcourt 2000 goes, but it doesn't go very well. June 20, 2001, Suns decide to go in a different direction and they trade Jason Kidd to the New Jersey Nets. Here's a quote from Brian Colangelo the day of the trade from ESPN.com. He says, quote, "This was a basketball judgment call regarding where we were as a franchise, where we're going, and what our preference was going forward. I hope and pray that it's a deal that both teams can look back on and say, this was a good deal for our team." Well, Rod Thorne, the Nets president, says Jason is the best rebounding point guard in the league. He's all NBA in defense, and we really need help on defense. On the whole, I think we helped our team dramatically. Okay, Rod Thorne, correct. Frank Colangelo, not so much, I would say. It's a big makeover for the Suns. They've been built around Kidd for years and years and years, but the franchise had experienced sagging attendance in recent years, and Kidd's off-the-court problems as well. Added to possibly this trade happening. If you don't remember at this time, I forget if he was arrested or charged. He was charged with some domestic abuse and some other things like that. And it just, he was kind of a surly guy in general, as Jason Kidd always would kind of be. So you had domestic abuse. You had him being kind of surly. You had some stuff a little bit here and there. And, Colangelo would say it's a general malaise on the part of our fans. So, they decided to go in a different direction here. He says this trade is necessary to bring some much-needed excitement and personality to the team. Brian Colangelo says here, which I think is a very vivid quote here, he says, "There were a lot of games I didn't enjoy myself, so how could I expect the fans to enjoy them?" So, wow. That's a pretty interesting case there. So he decides, hey, you know what? Enough of this Jason Kidd. Let's bring in Stephon Marbury. Well, the Suns stink. And he only lasts 2.5 years there, and then he's traded to the Knicks. So doesn't go very well. He's actually packaged with Anthony Hardaway as well, with Penny Hardaway. I forget that it was Penny Hardaway and Stephon Marbury to the Knicks for Howard Eisley, Antonio McDyess, Charlie Ward, and a bunch of other crap, which eventually, somehow, believe it or not, this trade in 2004 ended up involving a 2010 first-round pick, which ended up becoming Gordon Hayward. So that's what a weird connection of dating Penny Hardaway to Gordon Hayward through this one trade. Incredible stuff there. But anyway, Jason Kidd and the Nets end up being a perfect fit. Kidd joins the young core of Kenny Martin, Richard Jefferson, Kerry Kittles, Keith Van Horn. Team improves by 26 wins in their first season. And with their new point guard, they get their first 50-win season in franchise history. I had to double check that to make sure. And it's like, man.
That's NBA. They won more than 50 in the ABA, though.
Correct. Yeah, but obviously, NBA, it's like, pretty bad franchise for a lot of years. But anyway, Jason Kidd makes it all right for this period briefly. 51 season, Kidd makes the All-NBA first team. He finishes second in MVP to Tim Duncan. A lot of people upset about that because I remember this argument at the time because Tim Duncan is in his peak. Like, people say he's boring, you know, period. But like, yeah, it's tough to pick against Tim Duncan in that year, especially going back now with the benefit of hindsight and looking at numbers. It's like, yeah, Tim Duncan's clearly the MVP here. But I remember a lot of hand-wringing about it being Jason Kidd. And it makes sense because he was the narrative of that year. I mean, he improves that team by 26 wins. They're like immediately awesome. He's dynamic. He's throwing alley-oops. Kenny Martin's dunking all over the place. Richard Jefferson's doing cool stuff. Like, it's a really, really fun team at this time. Like, there's always this idea that this Nets were kind of boring and dull and the Eastern Conference was bad. And those, you know, some parts true, but like Jason Kidd really reinvigorated this team and really made them very fun. So I get why, like, narratively you might want to go with Jason Kidd as the MVP, but I think Tim Duncan historically would be the better pick.
I'm sorry, I need to interrupt for a moment. So outside of the 2002 season, the NBA Nets have never had a 50 win season.
What?
they've had four 49 win seasons.
Oh.
Now this season is obviously going to be shortened, 72 games. They're 37-17. They have a .685 winning percentage, which is their second best winning percentage outside of the 75 season. So let's see, they'd have to lose 22 games so if they finish 13-5, they would have they would win 50.
Okay, I think they can do it.
So winning percentage wise, they would be, if it were a full season, they would be above the 50 threshold. But anyway, so yeah, that's a weird thing.
You would have thought like that one of those like KG Pierce teams would have just like fell backwards into a 50-win season, right?
Right.
Like,
they won 49 that year. Man. Yeah, that was 2013. Yeah, they're with PJ Kosmo as the coach. That's
of
right.
Course. That was full circle.
Yeah, full circle. Yeah. Okay. Anyway,
you can't avoid PJ Carlissimo. But anyway,
sure.
Kid leaves New Jersey to their first ever NBA Finals appearance, where they meet the juggernaut Shaq and Kobe Lakers, who absolutely destroyed them in four games without any real attempt. Believe it or not, Jason McCulloch and Aaron Williams could not stop peak Shaquille O'Neal, who just dunked all over them. And it didn't matter what Jason Kidd or Kenny Martin or any of those guys were doing. It was going to be the Lakers, and they were going to win this. So the following season, New Jersey is back in the finals, this time in a pretty competitive series, actually an interestingly competitive series with the San Antonio Spurs. Like, yeah, that, a lot of people kind of forget, because people remember that four-game sweep, just the utter destruction of the Lakers the prior year. Like, the Nets, they had a real chance of maybe making this a series. Obviously, San Antonio wins it. They win a title in David Robinson's final season. And Tim Duncan's great that year. Everybody's great that year. So it just, you know, they were up against another juggernaut in a lot of ways, but they made it competitive, and they made it a pretty good series. So in the offseason, actually, it's very, very interesting. I think we talked about this a little bit when we talked about David Robinson a few months ago. There was speculation that Jason Kidd would be joining the Spurs in this offseason, replacing the Spurs' young point guard, Tony Parker. Because Tony Parker, they weren't quite sure what they had in this guy. They weren't quite sure if he was going to work. And Jason Kidd said, hey, I'd like to come there. They had the cap space. Everything worked out perfectly for Jason Kidd to go to the Spurs, join. Can you imagine the hand-wringing if Jason Kidd went to the defending champions? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Ended up not happening. Kidd stays with the Nets on a six-year, $99 million deal. You can't make it 100. You can't go around 100. 99, well, $99.8 million. Like, what are we doing? Come on, make it $100. But anyway, unfortunately, though, this is probably the high point for Kidd and the Nets. They'd be a middling team over the next few years. Kidd has numerous injuries. He ends up going through microfracture surgery, which almost never worked ever. And I don't know how it ever was thought of as being a good idea. But we've talked about that before. I don't understand how, hey, what if we just drill multiple holes into your knee? That'll make your knee better, right? Like, I don't know. I guess.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
Didn't work for anybody, but hey, you know what? Maybe it'll work for me. So it didn't. And now they don't do it anymore because it was bad. Anyway, the team acquires Vince Carter from the Raptors. You mentioned that a little bit earlier, to try and get things going again. And they were a constant in the Eastern Conference playoffs, but they never got to the high again. They never quite got to that level, like you said, of making the NBA Finals or winning 50 games or doing any of that sort of stuff. There are some notable things that happened, though. And, you know, April 7, 2007, Kidd and Carter become the first teammates to record triple doubles in the same game since Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen did it for the 89 Bulls. In 2007 as well, Kidd joins Wilt Chamberlain and Magic Johnson as the only players in NBA history to average a triple-double in multiple playoff series. Becomes only the second player in NBA history to average a triple-double for an entire postseason. In 2008, he becomes the third player in history to get a triple-double in three straight games. But again, the bloom is really off the rose in a lot of ways here for Kidd and the Nets. He's rumored to be a part of a deal sending him to the Lakers. But the Lakers do not want to give up Andrew Bynum, a pretty constant through many of these rumored trades the Lakers were in for years and years and years. They just never wanted to give up Andrew Bynum. But finally, on February 19th, they find a partner here, with Kidd being traded to the Dallas Mavericks, ending his run in New Jersey. And Jason Kidd, to this day, is still the Nets franchise leader in three-point field goals. He will probably lose that very soon, depending on how long James Harden plays for the team. He's also the franchise leader in assists, steals, triple-doubles, assists per game, and value over replacement player. He is second in win shares, only to Buck Williams, and fifth in points, which I don't know if this says more about Kidd or more about the Nets franchise, given that Kidd wasn't really known for being a great scorer, but he's fifth in Nets franchise history in points. Brook Lopez is currently number one. But again, depending on how long Kevin Durant and James Harden and Kyrie Irving play, a lot of those stats are probably going to get destroyed and blown up here pretty quick. So
yeah,
cherish it now, Jason, because I don't know how long a lot of those are going to last. So, yeah.
I will deeply cherish it, Rich. Thank you for encouraging me to do that, because I'm glad to. Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy. And of course, you know, obviously, you know, Kid goes to the Mavericks. A lot of people kind of thought like, you know, like Kid's past his prime.
Oh, I hated it. I was a huge Mavericks fan at that time. Me and my buddy were so pissed. We're like, what? What are they doing? Yeah. Jason Kidd, that's not going to work. Like, why did they? Why?
Trading future star Devin Harris? What are you doing?
Right, exactly. I loved Devin Harris at the time. Right. I was so pissed.
Right, yeah.
I wish I saved those text messages. I mean, me and my friend were like inconsolable at the time. We're like, what are they doing? Maurice Hager, like, come on. There's so much good talent going away for old-ass Jason Kidd. So, yeah, well, whatever.
Yeah, well, of course, they'd end up, you know, winning the championship with Kidd. You know, less of a role player now, but a key player.
Well, I didn't think he was going to start shooting three-pointers and making them every time. Like, what the hell?
Right. Yeah. Speaking of making three-pointers all the time for the Dallas Mavericks, Peja Stojakovic is our next category of taking a risk and trying to upgrade. So, The trade was Peja being traded by the Kings to the Pacers. This is January 25th, 2006, for Meta World Peace, who was still then known as Ron Artest. So, you know, this is sort of a different category of trade here, but it's basically getting rid of a longtime star or fan favorite in favor of a greater talent, but who maybe could create a volatile situation. So, to a degree, yeah, I would say this is kind of similar to the recent Kawhi Leonard for DeMar DeRozan trade, although that worked out much better for the Raptors than this did for the Kings.
I would say, but a lot of people forget though when that trade went down, it was like Kawhi was in the midst of his like weird season with the Spurs, where he kind of sat out, kind of didn't, and DeMar was like that franchise, and it was like, oh man, Kyle Lowry can't be happy about this. That's his best friend. That's a big. So yeah, that it all worked out, and people will kind of forget. But at the time, there was a lot of like, ooh, I don't know, is this gonna work? Like, what are you guys doing here? That's really weird. So I like that. That's a really good comp.
Yeah, thank you. Our test was coming off, you know, the previous year had been the Malice in the Palace. You know, he'd been suspended for most of the season. There were tensions with him and Pacers management, Larry Bird being the team president. And, you know, they had been trying to ship him for a while. And finally, this trade had been rumored for a while. Artest sort of seemed to sort of balk with going to Sacramento, but he finally agreed, and they finally were able to make the deal. The Kings co-owner, Gavin Malouf, said, hey, we're gamblers, so we'll take a chance on him. We want to look forward. Otherwise, we wouldn't have made this happen.
Those guys suck so much. You remember those guys? God, they were just the douchiest dudes. They just sat courtside in their douchey little suits. Oh my God, I hated the Maloofs. I loved the Kings, but then they would show their owners, and I was like, man, maybe Kobe and Shaq should beat these guys. Like, you know what I mean? Just we're gamblers. Oh yeah, they were just the broiest bros, man.
So
God.
At the time,
sorry to interrupt.
I appreciate the insight, Rich. It's very good. So, you know, he had, you know, and Sarkovich had been with the Kings, you know, since 1998. He was a rookie at age 21. He had become the team's longest tenured player. He was expected to become a free agent over the summer. He had an option on his last year. And Sacramento, they had traded away, you know, Chris Webber, Bobby Jackson, and Doug Christie over the past, 13 months. So, they were overhauling things. You know, they had four seasons of 55-plus wins from 01 to 04, you know, came really, really close to making the finals, but lost to the Lakers in 02, you know, with that fantastic team, and had a great run. They were still, you know, a pretty good team. They'd won 50 games the prior season. They were technically in last place, but they were in their division, but they were like, you know, they ended up making the playoffs and winning 44 games during the season. So it wasn't like they were a bad team yet. That would come soon, but they weren't a bad team yet. So Mike Bibby's quote about Artest, I know he might put us over the hump that we need. The way he plays good defense. He can score too. Maybe that can pick up the intensity in everybody else. So couple things you might be asking is, okay, why are you talking about Stojakovic? Why aren't you talking about, say, Chris Webber? Well, one, Chris Webber only played 377 games with the Kings, so he didn't quite fit our criteria. We did a minimum of 500 games with the franchise here. And also, you know, he was kind of a shell of himself after his injuries, so he wasn't really quite the same player. And also, Stojakovic, more important to the Kings' success than you might remember. For so 2001 to 04, you know, during that glory period for the franchise, he led the Kings in win shares and value over placement. He was second to Webber in box score plus minus and PER, averaging 21.3 points per game on .599 true shooting percentage. So really incredibly efficient scorer, especially for the era. And he was actually all NBA second team in 2004 and helped lead the team to the Kings 55 wins. That was the season in which Webber only played 23 games for the Kings. So, you know, really did lead, you know, the vestiges of that team, you know, to really good success. And, you know, they ended up losing into the second round of the Timberwolves, who had won like 59 games that year. And I mean, the West was just stacked during those years in which the Kings were great. I mean, obviously the Lakers won those three championships in a row, but you just had like, you know, four or five incredible teams after, you know, during that time. I mean, it was just a bloodbath there. So you're certainly one of the best teams to never win a championship. And yeah, I would say next to Webber, he was the second most important player, you know, of that era for them.
No, I think I definitely like what you're saying there. I mean, the Chris Webber stuff is obviously well known because, you know, when he comes, it kind of solidifies that team, and he's known as kind of the top dog of that team. But yeah, you're absolutely right that Peja was a lot more important than people remember. And I think a lot of people would be surprised if they go and look, you know, look at his numbers and look at his stats and look at what he was doing on a team that also had Chris Webber and had all the talent that we're saying. I mean, he was a super dynamic player. And unfortunately, as we're going to talk about here, the last half of his career kind of falls off a cliff and he just becomes, you know, kind of a role player for the last few years. But it really does undermine how important and how good he was for the Kings over the course of these few seasons. So I'm right with you. And yeah, he's like a Kings draft pick. He goes back all the way to 1996, the very famous 1996 NBA draft. Obviously, plays a few years, you know, outside of the NBA before finally coming over. But no, I think that's definitely defensible that he was a lot bigger deal than I think a lot of people give him credit for.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously they had Bibby. They had, you know, Divac. They had Bobby Jackson. I mean, they had a good, you know, a deep cast of really good players. But yeah, I think, you know, of the in terms of the key players next to Webber, I think it was Stojakovic, and I think it was close between them. I mean, Webber, I think, was definitely the number one player, but it was but Stojakovic was a strong number two. But yeah, so he, you know, Stojakovic for the Pacers, you know, averages almost 20 points per game in 40 games. Ends up missing four of the Pacers' six playoff games against the Nets that year with a knee injury, the Jason Kidd, Vince Carter Nets. Then he opts out of the final year of his contract to become a free agent, ends up signing with the Hornets after his agent had said he wanted to finish his career in Indiana. Apparently, Indiana wasn't that exciting. So, and I should say it's the New Orleans Hornets, now the Pelicans, because that's not confusing.
No. As we'll talk about very shortly. Yeah, not confusing at all. And yeah, when you're in the glitz and glamour of Sacramento, yeah, the you know, the cow town of Indianapolis is not enough to excite one Peja Stojakovic, who needed a little bit more juice that, you know, places like Sacramento can offer you. So
5 years, $64 million deal with them. You know, of course, joining Chris Paul, joining, you know, an exciting team that, yeah, I think would actually make a deep playoff run the next year or two. Unfortunately, Stojakovic really struggles with injuries for the Hornets. And as you said, just kind of settles into being a role player there. Then he, in the 2011 season, traded to the Raptors. We'd play exactly two games and then would be released and get to sign with the Mavericks in time for their championship run, and would make approximately a billion threes against the Lakers in their sweep of the Lakers in quite a glorious fashion. So he gets a ring at the end of his career, along with a lot of guys for the Mavericks, and certainly he kind of has a fun end there. Meanwhile, 2006 Kings, they, of course, led by Artest, Mike Bibby, kind of the last holdover from the old era. Also, Bonzi Wells. It's the last time the franchise made the playoffs. Been 15 years since they made the playoffs. If they don't make it this year, they would tie the record with the Clippers. So we'll see if that ends up happening. But yeah, Artest actually lasted 2.5 years with the Kings. You know, played pretty well. Ended up being traded to Houston for in a multiplayer deal that, which the, their main thing they got back was a first round pick that turned into Omri Caspi. Also, a trade that included former King Bobby Jackson going back to the Kings. So, and then of course, you know, he'd be 1 year with Houston before he'd go to the Lakers, and then kind of, you know, spent his legend there with the Lakers as kind of more of a, you know, defensive role player type guy, but. I think it made sense, you know, for the Kings to do that. I mean, I think it was worth a gamble. I mean, it didn't really work out, fantastically or anything. But, given where they were, I think, you know, it made sense to gamble on someone of Artest's talent. And they didn't have a whole lot of team success. But from a, you know, perspective of Artest, like, you know, he played well and didn't really get into, you know, any significant trouble during that time as well. So
right. And I think unfortunately a lot of people forget how great Artest was before that. Sure. Malice, like, and especially that year. Yeah. That year that he came back, like, he had been an all-star the year prior. He comes that year, you know, over the course of however many, I think 5 or 7 games, I forget, 5, 6, 7, somewhere around that range, I believe it is. It's definitely under 10 games. He's like averaging career highs around everything. And he's just like, the Indiana Pacers are a well-oiled machine. They look like a legit team that could probably make a run at the NBA Finals and maybe even at a championship. And then obviously the malice happens and it all kind of falls apart. But yeah, he was a really, really good player at that time. So you could definitely justify the trade and say, hey, look, you know, he just needed a change of scenery. He just needed to come to Sacramento. He just needed to kind of get away from everything that was in Indiana and everything that happened there and come. So yeah, totally justified trade. And obviously it doesn't work out perfectly, but you know, I like the idea to try to take a few more swings at this core, especially with a Mike Bibby, and see what you can do with it. And obviously it ended up not working, but it wouldn't have worked to Page to stay there for 2 more years either. Like, you know, I think that was kind of the writing was on the wall for that team and that franchise at that point. So I don't mind the trade. Not a bad move there, but let's move on to our final one here. Saying goodbye to a cult favorite, Muggsy Bogues. So yeah, Muggsy maybe, you know, the least impactful on the court player that we're going to talk about here, but I think I'm going to be able to sell it over the next 15 minutes. I think I'm going to be able to sell it because I think he's more impactful than a lot of people think on the court. Of course, not the traditional on the court star, but a really big star in terms of the marketing of a young franchise. A franchise that became one of the most top, you know, popular franchises in the NBA. A player that was synonymous with 90s basketball. I think many people to this day still remember Muggsy Bogues. They remember the Charlotte Hornets. They remember him on that jersey. Like, very iconic thing here. So I do say, you know, and definitely a cult favorite, which we're going to talk about here in a bit. And some other examples like Dan Majerle, you know, getting traded from the Suns. A pretty notable one as well. Just kind of a cult favorite that still probably has something to offer, like in terms of marketing and you know, off the court stuff that is sent away. But November 7th, 1997, he was traded by the Charlotte Hornets with Tony Delk to the Golden State Warriors for BJ Armstrong. So Bogues' journey in the NBA actually starts in the USBL, the minor league USBL, with the Rhode Island Goals. And like in the NBA, Bogues becomes an immediate fan favorite. The Goals lead the league in attendance during his 1 year with the team, and he plays very, very well with that team. 1987 NBA draft, Bogues is drafted 12th overall by the Washington Bullets. And at the time of his debut, interestingly enough, so obviously Muggsy Bogues, you're aware, he is short. That's why a lot of reason why people likes him, because he is very, very short, but he is able to do a lot of really cool stuff. At the time of his debut, he is 16.5 inches shorter than the average NBA player. I mean, that is a pretty astronomical difference there. More so, though, he is 28 inches shorter than his teammate, the 7'7" Manute Bol. And this would lead to, of course, many, many, many magazine covers showing the small guy Muggsy Bogues and the very tall guy Manute Bol. But unfortunately, it doesn't go as well for Muggsy Bogues in Washington. Things just don't go well with the Bullets. They don't really play him all that much. He's just kind of like a funny guy that comes out and does some stuff every so often, but not necessarily a guy that they really think they can build the future around. So he is left unprotected in the 1988 NBA expansion draft, and he's picked up by the brand new Charlotte Hornets franchise. Initially, mostly a bench player for the Hornets, but he ends up emerging as a starter, and I would say a damn good player in franchise history. So in 1989 to 1995, he finishes top 10 in the league in assists. assists and only once finished worse than fourth. I don't know if you would have said, hey, would Muggsy Bogues have finished top 10 in assists for the course of, like, you know, 5 or 6 years? I don't know if I would say yes. Like, he didn't strike me as that, but he did. He was in that mix there, was in the, you know, the top five for a lot of those years as well.
Yeah.
More than that, though, you know, him, Alonzo Mourning, Larry Johnson, the teal, the purple. I mean, that turned the Hornets franchise into one of the NBA's most popular, just a merchandise dynamo. Hornets starter jackets. Everybody had one. He was incredible. I mean, just an incredible presence. Like, people knew about him. He was marketable. He was short, but he was able to do incredible stuff. They marketed him great to kids. That franchise was, I mean, everything was firing on all cylinders for the Charlotte franchise. 1994, Bogues averages a double-double. He finishes second in assists per game that year as well. In 1995, he averaged a career-high 10.8 points per game. Unfortunately, though, he has a knee injury in that season, and that begins to really spell the end of his run as a solid NBA player, and unfortunately, his run with the Hornets. So in 1997, things get really dirty between the Hornets and Bogues. Then Hornets coach Dave Collins, who you mentioned a little bit earlier as well, basically suggests or implies or begs or whatever you want to say Muggsy Bogues to retire due to his knee injuries. Muggsy Bogues decides, I don't really want to do that. In August, Hornets owner George Shinn, who was a very good guy, Jason, a really likable guy that definitely did not cause this franchise to have to move and go away for a bunch of years because he was such a great owner, George Shinn. He assured fans that, no, do not worry. Muggsy Bogues is going to remain with the team forever. 2 months later, he's traded. So that's perfect. You know, in addition to the many other things that George Shinn does, he bold-faced lies to the fans and says, no, we're not going to trade Muggsy Bogues. Are you kidding? No way. And then trades him. So at the time, he's the franchise leader in steals and assists, which we'll talk about that in a bit here. As a bitter pill to swallow for Bogues, the fans, and the last remaining Hornets player, Del Curry. Del Curry has a quote here. He says, I don't think he would have wanted it to end this way. I don't know how I feel. That was the one guy George Shinn said would be a Hornet forever. So it hurt Del Curry. It hurt fans. And it hurt Muggsy Bogues as well. We'll talk about that in a bit. But to this day, Muggsy Bogues still the Hornets' all-time leader in assists and steals, second in games, second in minutes, and third in win shares as well. So I don't know that I would have assumed that even today in 2021 that he would still be the all-time leader in assists and steals and games and minutes and all that sort of stuff, be in the top five. But he is. So that's where I can really sell this, that, like, you know, whatever you want to say about Muggs, I mean, he was a big deal to that franchise, and he lasted beyond Mourning, beyond Johnson, beyond all those guys, really beyond, you know, the last guy was Del Curry of that original Hornets. But I think I was a little more surprised by how impactful he was on the court. But at the time of the trade, Bogues says that Charlotte will always be his home, but that he has severed all ties with the organization. He says he wants no part in having his number retired, and something that seemed like a foregone conclusion a few months ago. That's from the reaction article in ESPN.com of the of the trade. So the franchise still to this day has only retired Bobby Phil's number 13, but no other jerseys. Our friend Curtis Harris, he has a great piece about this in his Retired Jersey Project on the Pro Hoops History newsletter that talks about the Hornets and how they absolutely need to retire some numbers, including Muggsy Bogues' number. I mean, we can tell Malik Monk that he needs to take a new number. I think that's fine.
Yeah.
We need to get that number one in the rafters, man. We need to. But I don't know. I don't know if that is him still saying no. I know he was honored at a game earlier a few years ago, but I don't know. I don't know if he still doesn't want to do it, or if that franchise just decided not to. I'm led to believe that the franchise probably doesn't want to because they haven't retired anybody's number except for Bobby Phil's. But I don't know. I feel like in 2021, if you said, hey, Muggsy, can we retire your number? He'd probably say yes, but I don't know. I don't know. I couldn't find a definitive answer if he officially still to this day says, no, I don't want my number retired by them. So
I always think it's weird when franchises are so stingy with retiring numbers, and you know, the Hornets haven't had a lot of great players in the history, so I do kind of get to a degree that, you know, who else exactly would be worthy of that. I mean, they've had really good players, but none for like a very long time.
I would have definitely that first year that came back to, you know, Charlotte and came back to being the Hornets and not the Bobcats is what I'm seeing here on my screen. But that's seems Bob impossible. But Bobcats in Charlotte, that's weird.
I don't remember that.
I think that's USBL. I think that's a USBL team that Muggsy
played on. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Okay,
right. That's one of those minor league teams.
Yeah.
But when they come back and they're the Charlotte Hornets again, like, I probably would have that year decide, okay, you know, let's put Muggsy in the rafters, let's put Zoe in there, let's put Larry Johnson, you know, those sort of guys to really kind of say, hey, we're back and we're making that connection to the history. And especially now, as 90s nostalgia is just like insane right now. It seems hard to believe that this Charlotte franchise hasn't decided to, you know, reach out to those guys or figure out some way to get their numbers retired. But it didn't really end like it all ended on like terrible notes with all those guys. But I think all that is because George Shinn, who is a very good guy, though, Jason, really, really good guy.
Totally great guy.
Yeah. You would hope that like now with this new franchise, new leadership or whatever, that hopefully they would, you know, let it go. But I don't know. So I don't know if it's Muggsy on his own or Charlotte on their own. But I think I want that number one up in the rafters for sure.
Yeah, I think so. That would be good. I concur. I get mourning because he wasn't there that long and he's so synonymous with the Heat that that one may not make a lot of sense. I think Larry Johnson would, you'd like to see that one too. And maybe the relation, I don't know how the relationship is there, but
Kelly Tripucka, we'll see. Kelly Tripucka's number up there for sure.
So. Yeah. Get Kurt Rambis's number.
Flotty.
Yeah. Gerald Wallace. You can get Gerald Wallace up there. I take that one. He was really good.
He was a Hornet.
Theoretically. I mean, hey, if you look at the history books, then yeah, he was with the Hornets franchise. So
interesting. Don't believe it. Don't remember that at all. But okay.
I don't know. It's confusing, but you know, I mean, it's not confusing at all. It makes total sense. So, the 1988 Washington Bullets. I was just I was perusing the page. So interesting team. A lot of guys here. So you got Moses Malone, of course. You got Jeff Malone. So you got the Malones.
right.
You got Berardi,
the iconic Malones of the late 80s.
Moses
and Jeff.
Right. Moses and Jeff. Hey, Jeff Malone, he was a fun player. Bernard King, he's the his comeback season.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
You got hot plate John Williams. And you, of course, you got Muggsy and you got Manute. You got Charles Jones, one of the Jones brothers, one of the 1,000 Jones brothers who played in the NBA. You've got Steve Coulter and Terry Catledge. So you have the Catman. You got quite a little team there. You know, they only won 38 games.
But that I was going to say, I assume this team won 60 games and made a miraculous run to the finals. But
hey, once they ditched Kevin Lockery and got Wes Unseld as coach, they went 30-25.
There you go.
Hey, yeah. Inspired them to, they took the Pistons to 5 games in the first round. So let's look at that series and see. Let's see how close it was. The Pistons only won game 2 by 1 point. So, they hadn't won that game, the Bullets would have won the series.
There you go. Yeah.
That's
a pretty fun team. I always forget about Bernard King's late. Well, as many people probably do is watching.
Right.
That's a fun team.
He played really well for the Bullets. He had quite a few years of a good player there. But anyway, I believe we have we finished with our.
We're done. I'm looking at the expansion Charlotte Hornets, and I forget that their coach was named Dick Harter.
Yes.
Why don't you just go by Richard? Rick Harter. No one's ever going to make anything if your name is Rick Harter. But
I believe that there were 3 Dick coaches at that very time.
Because DJ Carlissimo.
Nelson. There was Dick Harter. There was Dick Versace, and I believe that there was another Dick coach at the same time. I'm looking right now to see if I can figure. I think Dick Motta was active in the league at that point.
Oh, right. I don't know about Dick Motta.
Dick Motta was kind of between coaching stints. Yeah, he became a coach again. He left Dallas in 87, and then he was coach for the Kings in 93.
Yeah, the Kings run. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Dick Harter he was a coach until 1990 as well, and then they fired his ass. But so he would count. So he would be in the same year as Dick Motta that year. So
and then I think Dick Versace also was a coach from 89 to 91. So it was a league full of dicks.
That's a ton of dicks in the NBA.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, thank you everyone for listening. Hopefully you enjoyed the show, and hopefully check out we've 260 plus episodes in the archives. So feel free to look back at those. A lot of good stuff there. Like luckily we talk about history, so most of the stuff we talk about is still timely, even if it's like 5 years later. So feel free to do that. You can find us at the stepbackatfansided.com. All kinds of great NBA content there. If you enjoy what we're doing, leave us a rating and review on the podcast provider of your choice. Helps listeners find the show and helps the good things. Please support our sponsor. Check out earthechofoods.com/minutemedia. Promo code MINUTE15. Get 15% off. And anything else? Is there anything, Rich?
That's it. Yeah, I would just say, yeah, earthechofoods.com/minutemedia. Use that promo code MINUTE15 and get 50% off is all I would say. But this is fun. I really enjoyed this episode. So hope you guys enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot, everyone. And we'll be back again soon.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.